from hoo-ha to ding-a-ling, from foo-foo to wiener. In almost every family, there's no shortage of safe words parents come up with to describe private parts to their kids. In the family of award-winning director, writer Robert O'Hara, they called his fun stick Booty Candy. So when he grew up, he wrote a play called Booty Candy that tells the coming-of-age story of a young boy who has to learn what it means to grow up gay and black.
Today, Booty Candy writer-director Robert O'Hara, who has been described as a cross between Lenny Bruce, Richard Pryor, and RuPaul, joins us to talk about Booty Candy, the cultural impact of Obama's presidency, how it's Tyler Perry's world, and we're just living in it. Also joining us is Chicago actor Osiris Capera, who, like Tyler Perry, plays a wide range of characters in the play.
I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
And this is Feast of Fun.
Not Shaven gives me more time for misbehaving. Get this sexy t-shirt and all our fabulous designs at feastoffun.com/store.
Booty Candy, a new play written by award-winning writer-director Robert O'Hara, tells the coming-of-age story of a young boy who has to learn what it means to grow up gay and black. He's here in the home studio. Robert's best described by some media as a cross between Lenny Bruce, Richard Pryor, and RuPaul. Also joining us is actor Osiris Capera, who plays the minister, father, and many other characters in Booty Candy. Welcome, guys.
What up, what up?
Thank you for having us.
So, Robert, does it feel comfortable sort of being compared to Lenny Bruce, Richard Pryor, and RuPaul? I mean, is that ring true to you?
No.
I think it was the New York Times that described
it. It was
that
Lenny again. Bruce and who?
Lenny Bruce, RuPaul, and Richard Pryor.
None of them are playwrights, and none of them that I know are writers particularly.
Yeah. Maybe RuPaul Richard did Pryor. Write Star Booty. Booty.
Star Booty Candy.
Wonderful. Yeah, I admire all of them, and I have a particular love for all of them, actually. So that is wonderful. But in terms of my work now, I wouldn't compare it.
Did you know Richard Pryor Jr., Richard Pryor's son, grew up to be a fantastic gay man and for a while was doing a lot of theater and doing drag as well? Mm-hmm.
Really?
That's fantastic.
Yeah, I forgot what his drag name was. We did an interview
Richard
with him.
Richard Pryor Jr.,
yeah.
Really?
Wow. Yeah, for a while he was living here in Chicago. He was a fantastic person.
That's one of my fantastic. First, I guess, writing jobs out of graduate school was to write Richard Pryor's biopic for Marty Scorsese. And so I had a series of meetings with Richard Pryor, and that was quite an experience, actually. But I've always loved him. He was out of control, which I loved.
Even in his later years, he was out of control?
Oh, yeah. This was when he was in a wheelchair and he had MS. He was still out of the box. Completely out of the box.
Well, he's on Netflix now. Have you watched his stand-up special?
I haven't. I've seen all of the stand-ups before because I had all of the videos and everything when I was doing the project, but I just can't bring myself to watch all. There's many documentaries about his life whenever, and that movie was never made, and there were several versions that were supposed to be made, and I'm still waiting for a movie of his life to be made.
Well, what I think maybe, the writer who compared you to those three other artists was starting to get to is that Booty Candy and a lot of your work sort of explores the themes and ideas of sexuality and taboos in a very unapologetic way.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and certainly thematically there are similarities. So I'm not afraid of the comparison, but, I just want to be compared to myself. My last thing I did, I guess. I don't know.
So no bringing up Tyler Perry in this interview.
Oh, absolutely. Please. I only compare his bank book to mine. You'll see a great comparison.
Well, it is interesting, though, because Tyler Perry, in some ways, is also like a black playwright and who's...
Yeah, he is a playwright.
Allegedly gay. Who is...
Who alleges that he's gay?
A lot of people in Atlanta. People.
too. Oh, okay. A lot of people who can't say it publicly, is, from what I understand, they have to sign non-disclosure agreements if they happen to make it to the upstairs of the mansion.
Oh, really? Yeah.
And part of it is, like, a lot of his plays are very tame in some ways in talking about sexuality and taboo matters, whereas a lot of your work is actually very upfront about it.
The most amazing thing is that I was teaching a college course about 10 years ago, and I asked the class to name me five black playwrights, and they only one they could name was Tyler Perry, and I was like, I don't even know who you're talking. I didn't even know who this person was, I think there were like three black people, and they were like, oh, I have a video of the show, and I'm like, what are you talking about?
On their phone,
about?
They have a video.
Well, mm-hmm. This was even before they did those sort of things, but he was selling videos. At his shows, at Tyler Perry's shows, you would walk out and you could get the video of the show. And and that's how he actually started making a ton of money, because then Lionsgate, I think, or something, bought those rights to those videos. And then they made movies out of them. So there was like this, and I'm sitting here with an MFA, and, you know, directing from Columbia in New York. And I'm like, who the hell is Tyler Perry? And now look. Like, and they're teaching me actually who a playwright is. So it was the strangest thing to watch his ascension, I guess it's called.
Well, know? They're sort of like morality plays in a sense, and Booty Candy sort of follows in the same spirit, in the sense that we're sort of like learning about a young man's experience of what it means to be gay and black in the United States.
Yeah, I think it really is you got the right word is experience, because the narrative is sort of embedded. Into the script. So it's real. I mean, there are some scenes that you'll go, I don't know what this has to do with the story. So the plays tells you, don't look for a story, come for the experience. And it usurps the ideal of narrative, and certainly a linear narrative. So it's about an experience, and it's sort of semi based on things, excuse me, that I have gone through or seen or experienced or dreamt about or daydreamed about. So that's where Booty Candy comes from.
What do you mean by the narratives embedded in the show? Is the whole show a narrative? Or
so that, you know, there's a series of scenes, and some of them don't feel like they're connected to the last scene. Most of them don't feel like they're connected to the last scene. So it's like, you know, it's like if you went to Disneyland, you could either follow the track that they, when you walk in, just go store to store and ride to ride, or you can just run around and you can have that experience of Disneyland too. So this is a play that sort of runs around the experience of being black and gay, as opposed to following a character from womb to tomb. So so one scene may not be directly connected to the next scene until later on in the play, and you'll go, oh, I understand how that is. And then some characters that seems peripheral will come back in another scene, and you will discover that you remember a name from a last scene. So it's that sort of thing, as opposed to, oh, this is Johnny. Now this is Johnny with Mark, and now this is Mark with Johnny, and they're eating. And like, that's not this play.
But you promise it all comes together at the end.
It does, but even if it didn't, it would still be valid. I mean,
it's like a collage.
Exactly.
A collage of scenes.
Yeah. It's like, you know,
to give you a feeling.
Exactly. It's like watching the Carol Burnett show and knowing that, you know, there's a Carol Burnett type of comedy, but it may not be, you know, the scenes may not be linked, but it's still the Carol Burnett show. You know, so, or like Laugh-In, or even like Saturday Night Live. So we know what we're getting in for, but we go for the experience. We don't go to figure out how this scene is connected to the last scene. You know, but there is a narrative that is embedded.
What is Booty Candy? Because you guys had a video where Osiris was going around Chicago. Boy, hi, Osiris. Right.
Hello.
And you were sort of given an impossible task to get people to figure out what the title of the show meant.
I just wanted to see if anybody had actually heard of it. I was genuinely shocked that nobody knew what it was.
I see the posters at the gym. It's you with white guy.
No, it's not me. Him.
That's that's not you? Okay.
That's not me. That's
it's a black guy and a white guy. It's a gender. I didn't pay much attention to the poster.
I told them to take that poster down.
Like the poster?
No. Is this the one with them on the back?
They're just kind of hugging each other and they're happy.
And I think there's a lollipop or something.
No, that's the New York one.
That's the New York one?
No. No, that doesn't happen in the play.
There's no candy in the play.
No, NTY, SAC.
So you were running around Boys Town asking people, do you know what booty candy is? What kind of answers were you expecting? Because mind, I was just like, well, what comes out of a booty that you can consider candy? And I was just
Why does it have to come out of the booty to be candy? I don't know.
And I was Lucy's stool, one of my favorite, drag queens in town.
What have we wanted to do?
Just saw her a couple of days ago. I don't know what I was expecting. I knew I was going to shock people. Mm-hmm. It was funny to me when I would like, because I can't go anywhere without running into somebody that I at least am familiar with. And I ran into somebody that I knew, and she emailed me the next day and was like, can you just not use that part? Because I don't really like being on camera and especially not ambushed on the street. And I was like, girl, ambushing you.
What did she answer?
she knew what the play was.
Okay.
She'd heard of the play before. She's in theater. So
and she's like, it's a brilliant play by writer-director Robert O'Hara.
He was compared to Richard Pryor.
He's like the RuPaul of Lenny Bruce of Richard. You know, the something of something is the nothing of nothing.
Right, exactly.
It's like, it's part of it is like they don't know what words to describe, you know, and you know, I would say like from what I've seen of Booty Candy, it's to me like the kind of plays that I like to go see because it's about sort of embracing and telling your truth and talking about your sexuality. And especially as gay men coming out of the AIDS crisis in the 90s, telling your stories was a powerful way to change hearts and minds.
Mm-hmm.
Most recently, there was a TED Talk about this, about people sort of knocking on doors and
chatting with people and having a conversation. Just by having a conversation with them, they're able to change people's minds on different prejudices they have, especially with like the transgender bills and, you know, Prop 8.
And in the, you know, in Prop 8 in California, a big reason that we were sort of able to overcome why we have marriage equality today is because of the hard groundwork of a lot of people just knocking on doors and telling their stories and changing hearts and minds that way. And I think actually theater and shows like yours are critical and invaluable in doing that.
And then you have Rex Reed, who printed in The Observer that I set back the cause of humanity 50 years.
I think Myra Breckinridge set back the cause of humanity. Heal thyself.
He seemed to like you, because I watched that video of you online as you're at the, what is it, the Cash and...
it was the TCG Gala.
Okay, and so you were talking about his, you read his review, and it seemed like he was a little titillated by it, but he also panned it.
Yes, I mean, he hated it. Hate. And I was like, we should absolutely use this review. It is the worst review on earth. And I think anyone that hates something that bad, everyone should see it.
Mm-hmm.
What did Rex Reed say exactly that was so like off-putting?
Well, he said it was racist. His whole review was racist.
Yeah.
But he said that people should boycott the play and that it was horrible language and stereotypical and vulgar and that he doesn't understand. There was a lot of animosity towards the New York Times because the New York Times raved about the play. Mm. And he said, once again, the New York Times has led us wrong. But he was just so offended by the blue humor of it. And by the audacity of watching characters that you don't normally see on stage say things you don't normally say. But as I said, he wrote, I set back the cause of humanity 50 years.
It's Rex Reed. He's a little. And Andy. I think his audience understands that he exaggerates a tiny bit.
So how did you feel about it when you first read it, and how do you feel about it now?
The funny thing is that when I read his review, I was in France at Versailles. And it was the most decadent place that I had ever been. And I read, and I was like, oh, well, Rex Reed, you know, wrote a review. Let me see this. And the show was still going on. And I read this review and I was like, oh my God, he hated it. And I was like, this is going to be something that I'm going to carry with me forever because I love that his animosity and just the horror. And so, because it was the direct opposite of the New York Times. So it proves that, you know, two people can watch the same thing and have completely different reactions, and you can't depend on either. Mm. So I can't, you know, fall in love with the New York Times review any more than I can hate Rex Reed's review. There's, you know, it's two white guys mm-hmm. who sat and watched the same show and they came up with different ideas. So I can't let it affect me. Either one of them affect me, really, mm-hmm. or the work. I just have to go back and do more work. That's all.
Does it matter to have a good or bad review at this point, as long as they're, you know, saying your name and talking about the show?
I think that it matters. It yeah. certainly matters to theaters yeah. and to their bottom line. I mean, it's called nonprofit. It's not called no profit. Yeah. So they want to get as many people as possible. I mean, there's certainly an audience mm-hmm. that you can market this play mm-hmm. to. But, you know, you want to have those people and their friends and their loved ones and everyone else to come see it.
Do you feel, though, that some people came to see it because of Rex Reed is, like, very polarizing. And a lot of people don't like him. And they know that he's really, you know, can exaggerate to the umpteenth degree. Do you think people read his review and said, I've got to go see this?
I hope so. I told the theater that you should put his entire review in an ad mm-hmm. and that because it was like, don't see this play. Mm-hmm. It's and I was like, that would be fantastic to have the entire review mm-hmm. of a play that you should not. I mean, I think Book of Mormon did something like that. Mm-hmm. And this other show called Something Rotten. They mm-hmm. like, it's like, we're going to have horrible reviews. Let's put the worst reviews or something mm-hmm. up and make that be.
And you feel like his review was racist. Do you feel?
Well, he called my play racist. Mm-hmm.
And no, you're the racist.
Right. He was
like, you, the black man, are the racist person.
And he was comparing, he said black people, he doesn't understand why black people weren't boycotting the play. Mm-hmm. He said that the white character in the play was the best thing in it and he should have jumped off the stage and ran for the hills. Mm-hmm. You know, he said horrible things.
Is there something, because your play is about growing up young and black, is there something like, do white people need like a bit of a primer to go see the show? Is there something that they need to understand or something
I don't
that
know
they
what
won't
white
get?
People need.
It's like, I watched Luke Cage on Netflix, and it's like, I pretty much got every reference, right. except for I had to Google what Alfre Woodard says, what do you want me to do, whip and nay nay, and I was like, what's
really?
That? And then it was just like, that's what my black friends said. They're like, you had to Google that? How did you not miss that? That was all over the internet. And I'm like, well, I probably saw it, and it just didn't register my mind.
Well, you so know, they don't know? Give us primers when we go see Woody okay. Allen.
That's yeah. true.
Or when we go see, you know, these superhero movies, but not a black person in the universe. Mm-hmm. So,
Richard Pryor was in Superman 3.
Exactly. So I don't think, no, I don't
we
think
were,
you need a
we went out for cocktails with Richard Pryor Jr. and he mm-hmm. bought us a drink. And I said, Superman 3 bought us this drink.
Yeah, this PBR. Oh my God.
I wonder who his mother was. Do we know who his mother was?
His mother lived in Indiana.
In Peoria,
yeah.
right?
In Peoria, yeah.
Right. Oh, wow.
She's a Peoria cool. girl.
She's a Midwestern mm-hmm. girl. So, I met a lot of his extended family, and they all look yeah. like each other. Like, yeah. they all, you know.
I think he's mid to late 50s.
Okay, so he was yeah. one of his early children.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, one of his early kids. And he grew up in Peoria, which is where his mother had the mm-hmm. bordello.
Yes.
Booty candy. As a kid, this is actually based on a true experience of yours.
Well, the entire play is based on experiences or ideas. Lies of experiences. So I may have, like, you know, there's a preacher in it that's sort of outrageous. And so my preacher that my grandmother would take me to her church, he wasn't as outrageous, but I would daydream that he would be more outrageous.
And that's where Osiris comes in yes. playing the minister.
Yes.
Exactly. And we yes. can't reveal certain things because some part of the fun of Booty Candy is I set the play up as a sort of normal, sort of a masterpiece theater. That's what I try to do in terms of the staging of it. And so that the outrageousness sort of pops off of the stage, you know. So Osiris is a preacher who has been given a letter by his congregation telling him to get rid of a certain section of the congregation.
Because shit.
God don't like sinful in the kingdom or whatever.
Yeah.
Booty candy is your mother used to point at your dick as a kid and say, this is boo-boo candy?
No.
What's the story?
This is answered 5 seconds into the play. But it was the term that my grandmother and my mother used for a little boy's penis. Instead of calling it a penis or a dick, it was called a booty candy. And you had to pull yourself back and wash if you were uncircumcised. So you had to put your foreskin back
okay.
and keep yourself clean. So part of that was cleanliness. that they were instilling in you as a kid. And they called the girls I think they called them their pocketbooks or something. I don't know.
So it was boo-boo candy and pocketbooks.
It was, yeah, because my mother said, you know, she saw the plan. She's like, by the way, it wasn't called booty candy. We called it boo-boo candy. I'm like, okay, that makes that even less sense. Yeah, so thanks for correcting that.
Because booty candy sounds more like a scatological thing, as Mark was pointing out earlier, or, you know, that your dick is meant to go inside your butt.
Well, this is what I've heard all my life. And then I was like, wait a second. I'm a homosexual adult male, and I just kept remembering that she kept calling the penis booty candy, and how ridiculous. And so part of my sort of upbringing is like my grandmother would make up these words, and like there, I would be going to school, and I would come back to my house, and then I would go visit my grandmother. We would have all these new words. So this was just another word. When I started writing this play, I was like, isn't that so funny that that's what was the word for penis?
It's because you heard what you wanted to.
Exactly. Probably. But the funny thing is that when we did the play, I did it once in Philadelphia, Philadelphia and New York, and I think that what they did is they had other people who came to see the show put what their parents called their private parts, and there were all these crazy things that parents
we called it peepee.
Yeah.
Right.
The weirdest thing I heard was my next door neighbor. Her mother called her daughter's vagina her value. And I was just kind of like, as a kid, I just thought it was kind of strange sounding. Right. And as an adult, I kind of like, God, they were weird.
Wait, was it value?
Value is like, this is what you're worth.
Right.
Oh my God.
You know? That is insanity.
But it's true. They say as long as you have
it's called our value. I love
it. It's true, though. As long as you have a pussy, you've got money in your wallet.
Okay. Well,
I don't know.
So, Osiris, how does somebody like audition for this kind of play?
You know, I walked into the room and I just wanted to be as crazy as possible. And I remember there was a moment where I got literally the best note I have ever been given in an audition ever from Mr. Robert O'Hara right here. And I don't even know if you remember saying this, but I will never forget it and hopefully have an opportunity to say this to someone else. So I'm there and I was actually auditioning with Travis Turner, who is playing Sutter in the show. We were doing a scene from the last gay play. Robert looks at us and he says, all right, that's all very buttoned up. It's all very nice and everything, but it's 4 a.m., and honey, I'm ready to go home, but bitch, not with you. And I was like, that's the direction? Okay, all right, I got this. I've done this before. I've been in that bar. I've been in that bar. Like, no, it was just it was like, it's late. It's the end of the night. It's girl, I'm ready to go home. Girl.
Urgency.
I'm wrecked to leave.
Okay.
You know, you've been in that bar.
Yeah.
With your good girlfriend.
Yeah.
Your bestest Judy ever. And y'all sitting around. And it's time to go. And it's like, all right, girl. So that note, I was like, okay, I know this. I have lived this. I think I did this yesterday.
Was that what sort of nailed it for you, Robert?
I have no idea what he's talking about.
You don't remember?
No, I don't remember. Why would I remember? It's like, you know.
What are you, like Carrie Fisher? You got electrocuted
every 6 months?
It's an audition, you know. And so you say lots of things to actors in auditions. I don't remember everything I said to an actor in audition. But I'm happy that it means something to them and it helps them. He obviously got the part, so he took the direction.
Well, the way you say that, it makes you sound so, like, you know, snobbish. Just like,
it's like, if your job... Right. Every day is to go and, you know, put data entry, you know, and someone goes, well, what about that number that you did last yesterday? It's like, no, my job is I'm auditioning people all the time. I think that people think of theater as a hobby and think of it as like, oh my God, you get to do the play and go and meet. I'm like, no, it's work. So seeing 40 people in the middle of the day and having to interact and be on with 40 people is tough. Mm-hmm. So no, I don't remember what I said, but I do understand that it's probably something that I would say because I know the character so well.
Who are you? You don't even remember guests we've had on the podcast before. People are like, I was on your show. He's
and
like, you were?
Calling you a guest snob.
I don't even remember people I hooked up with.
Oh.
So, now, as a writer, Robert, how do you avoid cliches in your writing? Because, like, if you look at the work, you know, Tyler Perry, you always have the the, you know, wholesome church going man who just wants to give a girl a break. You have the drug addict that, you know, gets into trouble. You have the drag queen who's sassy and outrageous. And for you, it's like, it seems like it's very important to come from a place of authenticity, even though these are very much, you know, it's fiction that you're writing.
Well, I want to defend Tyler Perry just for a moment.
Okay.
And that I think that Tyler Perry is writing to a particular audience. Mm-hmm. And his audience is a loyal audience. So I think that because we see the same sort of tropes in his work, doesn't mean that he's not sort of like writing to someone who believes in that stuff and that's the way they see the theater. So I don't have a particular audience that I'm writing. So my work changes by just the nature of what I'm writing about.
But wouldn't you agree that one of Tyler Perry's shortcomings is that sort of he relies on these characters that he's sort of, you know, some of them are characters that he's created, but he, you know, because it's part of it. It's a lot of fun to see Madea interacting with him in drag as the dad, as the grandfather, as other characters. And ultimately, it's like, it doesn't allow his writing to proceed. So when he's making a new movie, it's just basically like Madea in space, Madea Halloween, Madea this.
Well, Madea, you know, that. I'm not going to throw shade at Tyler Perry only because I feel like, you know, it's too easy that, you know, that there is a sort of formula that he sat upon and he is making a ton of money. And let me tell you something, I would be Tyler Perry in a heartbeat. If I thought I could write and pull out what he's pulled out, I would be Tyler Perry and would not care at all. There'd be a bunch of facts sitting around the table with podcasts.
Would you put
talking
on dress?
About me?
So let's rephrase the question. So is there a temptation or desire to sort of like develop a system for yourself and as a writer where you're sort of like, these are my tools that I can rely on as I create new stories?
Oh, you know, every now and then I try and think of the dumbest ideas possible and go, let me see how I can wrap that up into something interesting. I'm not this fan, like I have to come out and be saying something bold and inventive. I think that by the fact that I live as an African-American gay man in America, there's not many cliches that are presented to us on a regular basis in the media that I'm going to try and make a play about over and over. So I think that because of who I am, I see the world differently. And so my plays see the world differently.
Sure.
And so I don't know if Tyler Perry is writing from his own personal experience or if he's writing for the audience to identify with the audience's experience. But no, I don't think of it as a formula. I just think that, you know, I'm not the type of person that I'm going to write every day either. What I think is that when something is important for me, I have 1,000 ideas in my head and they sort of bump around. And then when they attach themselves to something that's interesting, then I start writing. And I don't know what the ending or the beginning is going to be. And if I do, it usually changes. So it's a very complicated process for me. Also, I'm a director, so I don't spend all my day thinking about what I'm going to write.
Is it tough to direct your own work, or is it? Do you think it makes it easier to direct it?
It's not tough to direct it. It's sort of like, you know, it's like sometimes I feel like, especially in American theater, that they think it's sort of like, you know, snobbish to want to direct your own work.
Okay. It really stings there.
Right. In other media, it's not snob. In other media, they let directors of film direct mm-hmm. their own dancers, will dance in their own mm-hmm. plays,
sure. or,
you know, in their own dances and stuff. So I don't think I'm a trained director. So that's just a skill I have. And but the difference is that a director has to be in front of people. Mm-hmm. And has to answer questions and be on all the time. Whereas a playwright can sort of just be in their room writing a play and doesn't have to be in front of people. So sometimes I want to be in front of people and sometimes I don't.
Now, how many times have you've staged this play? How many times now?
This is the fourth time I've staged this play.
Has something changed in the way you've directed the play? Is there something with a particular character that you liked it one way and then you're just like, you know what, let's work it another way this way and see how that works?
Well, you know, Chicago is very different because Chicago mm-hmm. has sort of storefronts. Mm-hmm. And so this is what's exciting to me. This is not, the other places that I've done the play have been in the sort of theater districts of those places. So there's a different type of crowd that is going to all the different plays around, right? And so this is not in a theater district, and you have to sort of find this play. Mm-hmm. And it's in a black box, and I've never staged a play in a black box. So we created a sort of formality in the set so that it feels like you're in a real theater and not mm-hmm. just, you know, a multi-purpose black box. So that is new. And the simplicity of this staging is new, because before, in the New York production, we had a revolving stage, and we had a fully realized set for each one of the scenes. And here we have several scenes happening just in front of the curtain, you know, so it feels.
That's why you compare it to Disneyland, that revolving
exactly.
stage.
Yes. You could go and just stay in the castle in Disneyland, and that would be your experience. And your entire experience of going to Disneyland would be like, I'm talking about this princess. Somebody else would go, I have 17 different experiences, and that still is experience of Disneyland. So it is sort of like every playlet or vignette in the play, it allows the audience to go, oh, it's another experience.
There's been an explosion, maybe, you know, an evening out of black actors, writers, comedians, and entertainers with the success of Hamilton, the musical, with Empire, and with Saturday Night Live, including more black voices in their work. Has that sort of affected how you work or your writing? Has it sort of been encouraging, or do you feel like you're sort of like there's more competition in some regards?
I have various opinions about it, but I feel, you know, the more people see difference, the more difference stands a chance. So, you know, I find it all to be very, very good and very, very, I didn't start doing the work I'm doing so that, you know, somehow black people could have a voice. I started because I'm an artist. And I happen to be black and happen to be gay. But what it does, it puts out there many images that you don't normally see. And so people can stop being afraid of it.
Why do you think Hamilton touched a nerve as much? Why is it such a huge success as it is, to the point that other Broadway theaters and productions are almost like eclipsed in its shadow?
I think it happens every so often that you have an artist hit upon something that is so incredibly innovative and brilliant, just downright right brilliant, that people acknowledge it, especially when you have such shit all the time around you, that something that is truly brilliant sort of rises, because usually mediocrity rises. Usually it's like we see a bunch of things and you go, well, what did you like? You're like, well, I liked da, 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 da. Everything sort of evens itself out. But when you have something so bold as to tell a story that has nothing but white people in it, really, and tell it with people of color, and then add hip hop to it, and then add a sort of audacity of staging and costumes, and that it reaches the elites, because a ticket on Broadway was never cheap, but certainly not now, and that it still reaches the masses over the ticket price, is sort of unique and amazing. And, you know, is Rent did that. You know, there's various times in our in the theater history where it happened, where you make a leap. And I think that Hamilton has made that leap for us. So we should all be grateful for Hamilton and look forward to the next leap.
Well, Cyrus, you're nodding your head.
yeah, I feel, ditto to pretty much everything he just said. I mean, it's when this phenomenon first started happening, Rent is the first thing that I thought of, actually, in terms of that kind of theatrical experience. I have not seen it yet, but I do know the whole thing.
If you go see it, for the people that see it, get the lyrics, because... you know, that they're going real fast. And,
or just spend a few days memorizing it.
Yeah, if you can.
It's worth it.
Yeah. Is this as a result of the, like, I mean, we just, President Obama's 8 years just finished. And I think there's a lot of, acknowledgement mm-hmm. that needs to be given to President Obama and his influence in our culture.
I think because President Obama was president, in part, this thing was able to shape itself in the first place. I'm interested to see what art is going to come out over the next couple of years.
Because Trump sort of the way Obama inspired people to be more diverse. And certainly, like Don Lemon may not be on the figurehead of CNN at this point if it wasn't for Obama. You know, they wanted to have voices and faces that reflected the president.
Sure.
And now, you know, people are sort of wanting voices and faces that reflect their new president. And that's quite disturbing.
Yeah. It's hard to get a naval orange to act.
There's actually a YouTube channel called Angry Orange.
Oh, there is.
And that's very popular. Robert?
What is it?
It's disheartening, isn't it?
I mean, you said you mentioned the new president, and I just, you know.
Your brain melted.
Fell out of my head.
Let's talk about the Oscars. Moonlight is a very important film. Nominated for Best Picture. Last year, Tangerine, another innovative film, didn't make it. What's your thoughts on Moonlight and Tangerine?
I enjoyed them both for what they were. I've been black and gay for a long time, so you know, it ain't nothing new to me. But I'm happy that the story is being told, and that I'm friends with Terrell McCraney, and I've worked with him before, and I just think it's the most wonderful thing for him and for the experiences that allows diversity. To grow.
Well, the interesting thing, because I feel like there's a lot of parallels between Booty Candy and Moonlight, and in a lot of ways is both are very experimental and have a very nonlinear quality to them.
Exactly. So if you like Moonlight, you should come see Booty Candy.
Exactly. Well, and I'm really, you know, I mean, we talk about Moonlight in terms of its value of talking about a gay black storyline. But really, Moonlight is also a very experimental film cinematography.
Very much
to the point, like, I'm not too crazy about the cinematography.
I think it was nominated for an award for cinematography.
Yeah, because it's pushing it so far that I felt like it distracts us from the story to a certain point.
Really?
Yeah.
I thought it worked well,
especially
amazing.
In the old, like, it was like everything was kind of blurry when he was young. So it was kind of like, because that's how your memory works, you know, it's kind of blurry.
I just love the lighting design, like that aspect of it, like the very strong contextual colors that are used in each segment.
Yeah.
That was so
beautiful. As photographers were trained not to photograph your person in green fluorescent lighting. and Moonlight has a lot of that in there, you know, it's like, and in some ways it is, there's a sort of like, I wouldn't call it like a Brooklyn or New York aesthetic, but it's about like looking at things we traditionally we think of as in Miami too, right?
It's Miami. So, I mean, if you think about like certain aspects of when you think Miami, there are certain colors that come to mind, and those colors are actually reflected very strongly in the context of the film, especially around his mother and the father figure of sorts that Mahershala Ali plays in the first sequence. Right. And, you know, you got Naomi Harris there. Don't screw up her name. Yes, Naomi. Yes, thank you so much. In the second portion there. And then as he is older, everything's much darker because he is older and he is much darker. So the lighting sequences change in aspect there.
You know, now that you said it, it totally makes sense.
It's also a movie about the experience. So it's a nonlinear, and the narrative is embedded because they will move forward in time. You're like, wait a second, where's that other guy? And you have to listen to find out what happened to the other person. Yeah. And why are we watching this scene? Because it doesn't follow directly onto the last scene. Uh-huh. You know, so there is experimentation in the storytelling itself.
Mm-hmm. So it seems like there's two schools of sort of black gay theater here. It's one of them is the nonlinear sort of experimental school that sort of presents a lot of personal information, and then there's the very traditional formalistic impersonal theater that's sort of best represented by plays like Tyler Perry's, I guess.
Well, I think that, you know, I don't subscribe to schools. I think that a playwright can be
or trends.
Trends, certainly they're trends. But I do think that there's a million ways to tell a story, and that these are just two of the stories that Tyler Perry is. hugely famous and hugely rich, so we are discussing him.
Right.
And well, it's kind of hard to talk about something without talking about the sort of the monolithic success of somebody else, wonder, similar to you.
I agree.
Does Tyler Perry actually fit into the idea of the black gay narrative in this regard? Because a lot of his stories don't even deal with the black gay narrative.
I don't know any that do.
Right.
And, well, it's and interesting because
yes, there is an overarching rumor about him, but no one, sure. It's neither confirmed nor denied from any perspective. So
I mean, the movie The Celluloid, did you see HBO's The Celluloid Closet? Yes. Michael Musto, or Musto, right? Or Vito Russo.
The documentary.
Vito Russo.
One of the ideas that he proposes that like homosexuality sometimes isn't overt. And that is it's a theme. It's a background character. It's the underwear that the actors are wearing. One example is Ben-Hur. Everybody knew to play that character as gay and having an affection for Charlton Heston's character. And that's what made it so powerful and so memorable.
But Charlton Heston had no clue.
He had no clue.
Everybody else did.
Right.
And, you know, I'm actually a fan of Tyler Perry's movies, and I think that we'll be thinking about them very differently in 50 years from now. And, you know, one day I hope to be an actor in one of the films.
Right.
You know, unflexible white person who gets upset about things while they're waiting in line and Madeira comes in and puts them in their place.
Well, she puts everybody in their place, but yes. I love going to his place. I mean, it is a whole experience. And when he comes to New York, I mean, you can barely get a ticket. And it's just, for me, it's a popcorn experience. Mm-hmm. I go and I'm in a community of people that I recognize. It's a show that is easily identifiable. We know what's going to happen from beginning to end. And then there's gospel music.
And it's comforting in some sense.
It's very comfortable. And that's,
but there's a lot of young black writers and gay people who are very put off by Tyler Perry's success, maybe, or their work, because it's so ubiquitous.
And it's also, people think of it as very simple in some ways.
I don't know of anybody who's
put
off by his success.
Get on the forums.
I said I don't know who's put off by his success, though.
It's ubiquitous.
I mean, honestly, from a business standpoint, as you said earlier, Tyler Perry is like one of the people that I would love to model a business aspect of a career after, because I think it's brilliant.
I think 2 years ago he was listed as the highest paid Hollywood celebrity of that year.
And I would not be surprised by that. I mean, he's the first person in the history of television to have sold a television series for 200 episodes sight unseen.
And he has his own studio, which is ridiculous. It's sort of crazy. So there are lots of aspects about his success that I find wonderful. I mean, you can argue with his sense of narrative and his storytelling, but that is something aside from the businessman that he is, which I think is sort of amazing, actually. And I don't think that everyone has to be fully blown, politically correct, and, you know, out there in the streets for the cause in order for me to appreciate whatever they're doing. Certainly, I don't think that. I mean, you look at, you know, the way the world is right now. Mm-hmm. I don't take issue with the categorization of black, gay, whatever, but my work is not black and gay, and my life is not black. I don't wake up in the morning and walk out my door and go, oh, my, let me have my black, gay life here. Like, most of the people
Some people it is, though.
Yes, but those people live inside a larger world, and I tend to, I want my work to be appreciated, and I believe I'm writing outside of just my personal sexual experience or lifestyle, but that there's a human quality to it, you know, and there's a society quality that I try and put into my work. So I like to try and have people come into the work and think they know what's going on, and then I can pull the rug from underneath them. So if you think Booty Candy is about the black gay experience, you should definitely come, because you will be very surprised.
Well, tell that to your publicist, then.
You have to sell something.
On the press release.
You have to sell something, and I think, but we want more than black gay people to come see it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, so you know, I think that the idea, because it's so specific, that is what makes it universal in a way. Is that you can find your experience inside the black gay experience as well.
Now, but you want all kinds of people to see it, because then you want people to show up on time. There's a hallmark of a lot of Tyler Perry plays is that
he will stop the production when people are coming in late and be like, oh, you just decided to join us, did you?
Exactly.
Okay, I have to be honest. I am not given the liberty to pull anything like that with Robert's work. And neither would
but
I.
But you want to.
But yesterday, we had four people walk in the middle of the scene as the preacher is preaching.
This is the second scene.
And I
don't
was,
say what you were in. And don't and say what
I wasn't going to. Okay. I was going to say, because the preacher is preaching, I had liberty in that moment to completely point out to them exactly what I was saying. Like, oh, I see you.
And did you do that?
I did.
Yeah.
I definitely did in the context of the line, but I'm able to deliver the line. So if you come late.
Make sure you skip the sentence.
You will get called out via the context of the text of the play, but it's going to happen because, you know.
You may come in and there may be somebody talking about some stuff that is a little dirty. So that's always fun to see, you know, someone sitting down when you have like people talking about, you know, dicks and what have you.
Well, it's interesting meeting you, Robert, because your work is in some ways has a very different personality than you have.
I would hope so.
Right? It's very like...
It's called creativity. I would hope that I'm not trapped by who I am in terms of who I'm writing. Certainly, you know, if I write science fiction, doesn't mean that I have antlers on. You know, sure. Or that I'm going to be growing, you know...
Booty candy in space.
Exactly. So, yeah, but I like that idea. A lot of people say that to me. They say, oh, my God, this you wrote this play? And I'm like, yeah. And I hope that
you're very low key. And Booty Candy is like the polar opposite of that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But that's what writing is for me. It's like putting yourself in places which you don't normally go and can't go, actually. I mean, you can't live a life like Booty Candy. You'd be dead very early on at that speed that play goes and the experiences that happen there.
You do have like your voice sort of reminds me a lot of people from who, especially African Americans, who come from one community and move to the East Coast and sort of have a lot of travel and experiences and education that then affects the way they speak. Like one of my patron saint, Eartha Kitt.
Yes.
Right, because Eartha did not grow up talking like that.
Right. Well, you know, I had a Southern grandmother, and I also had a lot of education. So, you know, what happens is you would go and see hear these big words, and then you would go back to your grandmother's house, and you would hear these like crazy words, and they sort of meshed into each other. So some people always say, "Where are you from?" Because they can't really locate it. But Cincinnati is where I was born and raised.
Just something like Eartha Kitt, you know, I grew up in a little town in South Carolina. Then I got a dance scholarship.
Just
and
make
traveled
it up.
Around the world and fell in love with a Maharaji who gave me a bunch of diamonds and wouldn't let me leave the country.
Right.
And then married another man and got blacklisted by the White House for speaking my mind out on the Vietnam War. And then became a countercultural figure for many years until I made a comeback by being a voice of a villain in a Disney movie.
And where is that play?
That's called The Eartha Kitt Story.
Get working on it.
Great. Actually, half of her life story is in a Tuesday's Child. Mm. Is a and you know Diary of a Yellow Girl.
Well, I think she would get a book. She'd do her autobiography, and every now and then she'd just republish it with a few more chapters. It's called versioning. She was versioning long before Apple and Microsoft were.
That's fabulous.
Yeah.
Well, I would drink a hot pot of coffee and lock myself up in my dressing room and write until the words would not come out anymore.
Why do you guys know so much about black people?
I know a lot about Eartha Kitt.
Do you want us to show you our award? We actually have an award for...
From black people.
African-American.
I meant to pull it out.
What is it for?
It's called the Esteem Award for coverage of the African-American experience.
Oh, really?
Really? Okay.
Because, you know,
everybody loves
it. I'm from Puerto Rico, and Puerto Ricans love flavor. And not all black people have flavor.
Right.
No.
But the ones that do, do it very well.
Yes. You have to laugh through it.
Robert O'Hara, it's a pleasure talking to you. Looking forward to seeing the show. Osiris Cabrera plays the minister, the father, and you're in drag too, right?
I'm also playing... Grandma. I'm granny.
The granny in drag.
Yes.
Booty Candy opens February 2nd at the Windy City Playhouse here in Chicago and runs until April 15th. you gotta go buy tickets.
You have 17 years to come see this play.
It's a pretty long run here for Chicago.
But you know, Windy City Playhouse does that. That's one of the things. They do have long runs.
Home?
I have no idea.
No, really?
Maybe.
Yeah, but don't take your time.
I have no idea. I don't know the history of that building.
Because you know the last week of the run, Robert. Yes. Everybody like, and their grandmama's auntie. What do you mean there's no tickets left? My grandmother's in town.
I saw the poster at the gym, and I thought I could.
Yeah. Where's the ginger?
Is there a ginger in the show?
I don't know. Is he a ginger?
I don't think he's a ginger.
I don't think he's a
ginger. Well, the poster makes him look like it. So.
He might be.
Hopefully, you know, there's a lot of nice.
You know
sex
what?
Scene.
He and I actually had a conversation about his hair. So, no, he is a blonde with a little bit of a strawberry hint. We did actually have that conversation.
He's a day walker.
Red is beautiful.
Under certain lights, his hair looks red.
Yeah. Red lights.
Well, I hope you guys have a great run of the show. And I can't wait to see it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Bye, everybody.
Bye. Bye.